mandolin collection, the 8 being a reference to the number of strings on the mandolin. So we'll leave you with this one. This is called Big Mon. This is a song, it's an American song from Bluegrass Boys. Big Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys with a tribute to the leader of the band there, Big Mon. Here's nice picking. JP Cormier, thanks for listening. See you all next week for more on Happy Town, next Thursday at 6.
Morning, students. Question. If Queens doesn't offer its workers a fair contract by February 3rd, who will be affected? Anyone? Answer. Those who live in residence, use university facilities, eat in campus cafeterias, and attend classes and labs.
So basically everyone.
Correct. It's time for Queens to take responsibility and ensure the well-being of their workers and students.
Message brought to you by QP Locals 229-254 and 1302.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will focus on the ceasefire reached in Gaza. We will look into what are the political reasons in the U.S. that allowed for the ceasefire. How did the far-right politicians in Israel react to the ceasefire? Was the occupied West Bank promised to Israel as an exchange for the deal in Gaza? What is the role of the Palestinian Authority and should it dismantle itself? Who are the Palestinian prisoners who are being released and in what conditions they were held? What does the ceasefire mean for Palestinians and can it be trusted to last? And finally, how can Palestinians rebuild Gaza after the massive destruction that Israel caused and the trauma of genocide? Stay tuned.
Celebrations were held in Gaza and Israel Wednesday after the announcement that Israel and Hamas had agreed to a 6-week ceasefire and hostage deal. Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani outlined part of the deal on Wednesday.
Qatar, the Arab Republic of Egypt, and the United States are happy to announce the success of joint mediation efforts in order to reach a deal between the parties of the conflict in the Gaza territory to exchange prisoners and hostages and a return to a prolonged truce that achieves a permanent ceasefire between the two sides, in addition to an agreement for the delivery of large amounts of humanitarian relief and aid to the Palestinian brothers in the Gaza Strip.
President Biden said the deal is based on the ceasefire plan he outlined last May. In recent weeks, the Biden administration worked with representatives from the incoming Trump administration to negotiate the ceasefire deal, which is scheduled to begin on Sunday, the last full day of Biden's presidency. Under the terms of the deal, Hamas would release 33 Israeli hostages over the next 6 weeks, with the first hostages being released on Sunday. In exchange, Israel will release 1,000 Palestinians imprisoned in Israel over the 6-week period. The deal also calls for Israel to pull back its troops from populated areas of Gaza and for Israel to allow 600 aid trucks into Gaza a day.
This comes as authorities in Gaza say Israel's killed at least 81 Palestinians over the last 24 hours. The official death toll in Gaza is nearing 47,000. But just last week, the Lancet Medical Journal said the actual toll may be 40% higher.
So, Mohammed Shahada, I want to ask you about a piece that you recently published, which was based on conversations with numerous Israeli, Palestinian, and Arab officials involved in the talks. They all expressed surprise, including the Israeli officials, that the Biden administration has continued to publicly blame Hamas as the obstacle to a ceasefire when it was clear to all involved that it was Netanyahu who was holding up the agreement. So if you could respond to the terms of the agreement that was passed yesterday, agreed upon yesterday.
I'll start with the first issue on the terms of the agreement. It is literally word for word. I read the whole text very carefully. It's word for word, the same text as the one that was produced by Israel's own team on the 27th of May 2024, so about 7 to 8 months ago. Hamas accepted it on July 2nd. Hamas was informed by mediators that the Israeli team gave a positive response as well. Netanyahu immediately rejected it as soon as Hamas's answer was given and imposed four conditions that his own generals, his own advisors, his own negotiators said that these conditions are impossible and render a deal unfeasible, but he insisted on them. The Biden administration immediately took a very easy approach. They decided to absolve themselves of any responsibility for refusing or failing to pressure Netanyahu by rewriting history. That's what a very senior Israeli security official told me recently in November. He said Biden's team is engaging in a shameful attempt to rewrite history, basically gaslighting, putting all blame on Hamas so that it sounds that they tried their best with Netanyahu, they got him to accept, and Hamas is to blame. The other thing is that mediators and Israel's own negotiating team have been begging Biden's team for months to name and shame Netanyahu, believing that it can create some domestic pressure on him. Biden refused consistently. We know yesterday in the Times of Israel, it came out citing Israeli negotiators that Blinken, when he used the narrative of saying Netanyahu accepted, Hamas rejected, it threw a wrench in the negotiations and collapsed them. That's what an Israeli negotiator himself said. So in a way, we had a consistent effort by Biden's team to cover up and buy time for the unfolding genocide in Gaza.
Let me bring Jeremy Scahill into this conversation. Jeremy, just before the ceasefire was announced yesterday, you wrote a piece on the Trump factor. Yesterday, President Biden spoke twice, right after the announcement, which also puts enormous pressure on Netanyahu, since all the world and networks are reporting there's a deal, and yet he is trying to bring together his coalition to support it. Biden spoke both in the afternoon, and he gave his farewell address from the Resolute Desk in the Oval Office last night and said, "This is my deal from May," though did give a nod to President-elect Trump, weighing in at the same time as if there's two governments. Explain what the difference is this time from when Biden did put this forward in May.
Well, you know, it's very clear if you read the Israeli press and listen to Israeli politicians and political leaders that this deal would not be signed, certainly not at this time, but for the intervention of Donald Trump. And much of the media coverage of Trump's threats on this were focused on Hamas, because Trump kept saying if the hostages aren't released, there's going to be hell unleashed in the Middle East. And, you know, he wasn't specifying what his threat was, but it was, you know, most of it was focused on Hamas. But what happened was that, you know, Trump's special envoy to the Middle East is not someone like an Antony Blinken or a Henry Kissinger. Instead, it's kind of, you know, like a scene from The Godfather where Tom Hagen gets sent as the consigliere to sort of do the bidding of the Don. He sent another billionaire real estate tycoon, Steve Witkoff, to the region. And Witkoff then is in the room with CIA Director Bill Burns, with Brett McGurk, the current envoy, with all of these mediators. And we understand from Israeli media coverage that last Friday, Witkoff is in Doha. He calls Netanyahu's people and says, "I'm coming tomorrow to Israel, and I expect Netanyahu to be there." And they say, "Oh, well, no, it's Shabbat. He's not going to be able to meet with you." And Witkoff, who himself is Jewish, was like, "I don't care what day it is." He arrives there and, by all accounts, sort of said, "This deal is going to happen before President-elect Trump takes office. Now, some of this, I think, is true, and I don't think we can understate the role that Trump played in forcing this deal through, and it really exposes the utter moral rot that existed within the Biden White House on this issue of stopping the war, because before he even gets into office, Trump is showing the vast powers of the American presidency. He's doing it in an unorthodox way. He's doing it before he assumes office, but it just shows that Joe Biden could have ended this long ago if he used some of the levers of American power available to him, as Daniel said. This does benefit Netanyahu to an extent, because it can sort of be portrayed as, you know, Trump forced us into doing this. But the devil's in the details. Last night, Mike Waltz, Trump's incoming national security advisor, echoed something that Netanyahu has been hinting at, which is that the Israelis view this as a bitter pill that they have to swallow right now, but they're not even talking about phase two and phase three. Netanyahu really is sort of implying, and Mike Waltz co-signed that last night in interviews, that it's really just a phase one deal, and that once we get a decent number of hostages released from Gaza, then we can resume the war. Trump's national security advisor said that the aim of totally destroying Hamas and demilitarizing Gaza is a just one that the United States supports. So while Trump should be given credit for doing something that Biden and Harris systematically refused to do, this remains an extremely dangerous moment, as evidenced by the fact that Netanyahu has now ordered his forces into a full spectrum, full scale attack against the Palestinians of Gaza leading up to Sunday. One last point, Amy, echoing some of what Mohammed and Daniel said. This narrative that Hamas has been the impediment to a ceasefire has been a lie for this entire time. From the very beginning, Hamas officials told Israeli negotiators and others that they wanted to make a deal to exchange the Israelis taken on October 7th for Palestinians being held. Antony Blinken has been the liar in chief promoting this narrative. I was shown a document, Amy, this week that was signed by Hamas's negotiators, all of them, and it was a copy of the ceasefire agreement that Hamas's team signed and stamped on Monday. Every day after that, leading up to Wednesday, so all through the evening Monday, all through the day Tuesday, all through the day Wednesday, Antony Blinken and Israeli officials kept saying, we're just waiting on Hamas to accept the deal. I have seen proof that Hamas actually formally accepted the terms of the ceasefire on Monday, and Blinken and the Americans knew this, and they continued to feed into this lie. That's indicative of this whole story that's been going on for almost a year and a half, where a genocide has been committed against the Palestinian people, and the United States has not just serviced it with weapons and political support, but also consistently promoting lies, and a narrative that ultimately was very, very lethal.
And Jeremy, if you could elaborate on why you think it is that it was so important for Trump to get this deal agreed upon. And I'd just like to read comments that a former director general of Israel's foreign ministry made earlier today, saying that this total victory for Israel, he called the ceasefire agreement a total victory for Israel, happened not in Gaza, but in Washington. Trump is seen as a total victory for Israel, has so much to benefit from Trump regarding its international status and other issues. So if you could respond, Jeremy.
Well, you know, let's remember that, you know, Trump is an unorthodox political figure. Whatever anyone thinks about him, he's an unusual character in the history of the American presidency, and he is not a creature of the Washington swamp. He may be a creature of other kinds of swamps, but he's not a creature of the Washington swamp. And I think Trump wanted to sail into his inauguration with what he could claim was like a major diplomatic victory in a war that has gone on for 16 months, and which quite likely was the defining factor that cost Kamala Harris the election against Donald Trump. On a different level, I think that Trump has a much broader agenda. I don't think he particularly wants to see the Middle East in flames when he takes power. He's very, very interested in getting a normalization agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel. I think that's one of the prizes that he's going to move toward handing Netanyahu in all of this. But there's also some really dangerous things at play that extend beyond that normalization agreement with Saudi Arabia. The West Bank Israel wants to fully and officially annex the West Bank. Trump's number one donor, Miriam Adelson, has made very clear she wants the West Bank annexed. Mike Huckabee, the incoming U.S. ambassador to Israel, has said there's no such thing as a Palestinian, no such territory as the West Bank. So let's not pretend for a moment that Trump was motivated by humanitarian, sort of concern. But he is viewing this, I think, as a business transaction. And Trump wants capitalism in the Middle East. And he ultimately endorses an agenda that is going to be very bad for the Palestinian people. But in the short term, no question, Donald Trump was the defining factor in forcing this through.
Muin Rabbani, we want to get your response to what's happening right now. Can you talk about the significance of this and how this came about? President Biden saying this is my deal, though giving a nod to President Trump, and Trump saying he's ungracious and not saying it was his envoy that sealed this deal, that forced his ally, Netanyahu, to finally sign off on the ceasefire.
Well, it's quite clear that Biden had next to nothing to do with this deal. This is a deal that was formulated by Netanyahu and presented on his behalf by Biden in May of last year and was accepted by Hamas in early July of last year. And the primary missing element has been Israel's agreement to this text. And the only reason that Israel did not agree to this text until this week is because it didn't have to worry about U.S. pressure. What it in fact had was unconditional U.S. support and U.S. Collusion. And it's quite clear that the only thing that has changed in the past month is that there was a unambiguous message from the incoming Trump team to Netanyahu that they do not want to have to deal with the Middle East, with a foreign policy crisis during the inauguration and on their first day in office. And they especially don't want to deal with a crisis that includes American hostages in the Middle East. They want to be Ronald Reagan in 1981, not Jimmy Carter. And I think Netanyahu...
And explain what you mean by that, Muin.
Well, I'm referring to the Iranian hostage crisis that is considered a large contributor to Jimmy Carter's election loss in 1980, and that those American hostages were not released until after Carter had left the White House and Reagan had entered it. And Trump very clearly does not want to be a Carter. He wants to be a Reagan in this respect. Netanyahu understood the message loud and clear. And so he signed on the dotted line. Netanyahu is now hoping that with Trump so narrowly focused on January 20th, that he lose interest within a few weeks, and Netanyahu will then be able to scuttle the deal when it gets to when the first phase ends. The second stage is still being negotiated and is yet to be finalized.
Andreas, you've seen the deal. We've all seen the deal. It's a phased deal. What are the pitfalls that you see, the most obvious ones? Where could this fail quickly, or is it going to fail after the first hurdle, after the first phase?
Oh, I mean, it's quite obvious why both parties went to a phased deal, because they're still on diametrically opposed, sides of the divide, and they have diametrically opposed objectives. So that this kind of deal is as good as it gets. But let's be honest here. I mean, for now, this is a hostage slash prisoner exchange deal. This is not a ceasefire deal. There will be a truce attached to the exchange of prisoners. But if you look at the rhetoric, if you look at the intent, particularly on the side of Israel, of that Israeli government, there is no real intent to bring the war to an end. And there are quite a lot of stepping stones along the way. If the greatest concession I think that Hamas has made, already last summer when the deal could have been had in the first instance, is that they are allowing Israel to remain within the Gaza Strip. So we're having a phased withdrawal, but in phase one, Israel will, even at the end of phase one, Israel will remain within especially within the Netzarim corridor. And if you then look at phase two, which is extremely ambiguous already, even then Israel has a lot of sort of levers it can use to remain. So it doesn't bring the war to an end per se. It's kind of creating a window to, for the exchange of prisoners. And I think that as well is tied to the delivery of humanitarian aid. And here is another issue. Humanitarian aid can be brought into the Gaza Strip, but how it will be distributed, how it will be secured without a law enforcement on the ground, big question marks. And if one of the deliverable is humanitarian aid and it won't be delivered, will Hamas just stop the deal and stop the exchange of prisoners? Because mind you, that's how the deal in November 2023 eventually came to an end. So, you know, optimism is great, but let's be honest. I mean, this is a first phase and we have no bridge into phase two yet.
Yossi, let me bring you in here. One of the problems with this deal, why it was so difficult to get in the first place, was internal Israeli politics. The far-right ministers, Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, opposed to this deal completely. They are still a force to be reckoned with in Israeli politics, and they're looking for the war to continue. How much pressure is that putting on Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister?
Much less than before. I mean, apparently before they were critical, and Ben-Gvir himself just said a few days ago that he was the one who prevented the agreements from being signed in the past. Now, according to his promise, he's going to resign once the government approves the deal, meaning in an hour or less. Which between us is a great relief for many of us. So he will not be in the government as a veto holder. And the government, on the one hand, has a majority, but it doesn't need a majority because the opposition will wholeheartedly support any deal. Including, of course, the current deal. So first of all, the government will easily implement it or sign it, or and the exchange of prisoners and hostages will happen all from Sunday on. For the future, it might be more difficult for Netanyahu to hold this coalition, and the opposition will give him, I presume so, a safety nest so that he's not going to fall.
Gideon, you're in Tel Aviv. As we broadcast right now, the security cabinet, the war cabinet, has just voted for the ceasefire deal. It now goes to the larger cabinet. Explain the significance of this and the resistance.
No significance at all, because the first phase will be implemented from Sunday. Those are rituals, but once Netanyahu decided that he's willing to go for the first phase of the deal, this phase will go to its way. The main challenge will be the second phase. And here there are many, many problems in the horizon. But right now we are going through the motions, the cabinet and then the government, and two ministers will speak against it, and all the others will be in favor of it. And Sunday, the first hostages are going to be released.
Ben-Gvir, along with another MK, member of Knesset, or known around the world as member of parliament, the significance of the far-right member of the cabinet and member of the Knesset, Ben-Gvir quitting?
Well, Ben-Gvir also admitted that he was successful in holding up this deal for months, which should be criminal, and he should be treated as criminal in the eyes of the Israeli public. I started by saying that this is a bad deal, but a bad deal is better than no deal. Certainly, Ben-Gvir's resignation from the cabinet and not being our Minister for National Security is a cherry on the cake that was unexpected, and it certainly make the deal a little bit sweeter for us Israelis who would like to live in a normal country. Ben-Gvir is a danger to our society. He's a danger to our democracy. I think he's a danger to the entire region. And the further away he is from power, the better it is for all of us.
Does he remain in the parliament or in the Knesset, or just quit as a cabinet member?
He just quits as a cabinet member. He remains in the parliament. But a number of the parliamentarians from his party became members of parliament on what's called the Norwegian War here. When ministers enter the government, they can resign their Knesset seat, their parliament seat, and bring in additional people from the party. Apparently, two of the members of his party now have to also be removed from the Knesset, which is also a blessing.
And Bezalel Smotrich did ultimately, though he threatened to leave, remain.
Yeah, he remained. He cynically put out a tweet on X congratulating the return of the hostages that he tried to block. He voted against the deal. There's no end to the cynicism within the Israeli government.
Moin Rabbani, talk about that second stage, though, what we understand and what Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and also talk about their histories and even with the Israeli government, them being gone after for example, terrorism. If you can talk about what their objections are when it comes to the Israeli military in Gaza.
Well, they share, in fact, Netanyahu's objections. One of Netanyahu's previous. So again, we need to recall this is not an American initiative. This is an initiative that, according to Biden, was formulated by Netanyahu and merely presented by the Americans. And what happened after it was presented and after it was accepted by Hamas in July, Netanyahu began adding new conditions that Israel would have to retain a permanent presence in the so-called Netzarim corridor bisecting the Gaza Strip, the so-called Philadelphia corridor abutting the Egyptian border, and most importantly, that there could be no formal end to hostilities. In other words, there would be no definitive ceasefire. So it seems that Netanyahu's expectation was that Hamas would sign an agreement that would oblige it to release all the Israeli captives and hostages, and then accept that once the last one was released, Israel could resume its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Clearly, a condition designed to be rejected. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are insisting that they cannot accept any deal that ends Israel's military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And what they've said is they're against this deal. Ben-Gvir will leave the government. They will vote against it. But they will continue to support Netanyahu against any no-confidence measures, and that if and when Netanyahu resumes this genocidal campaign, they will rejoin. They will rejoin the government. So it's really a very, very empty threat. I see it as pure theater.
This is President-elect Trump's national security advisor nominee Mike Waltz in an interview with Fox and Friends Thursday, following news that the Prime Minister Netanyahu was again delaying the vote to approve the Gaza ceasefire and hostage deal.
No one has done more for Israel than President Trump. We will have their back to make sure Hamas never exists as a terrorist state and certainly does not govern Gaza.
Your response to that, Moin Rabbani?
Well, Israel has been at it for 15 months and still has a very long way to go. And if one assumes that it's virtually impossible for the Trump administration to provide more and more unconditional support to Israel than Biden has, I'm not quite sure what he means by that.
What has Trump promised, do you think, to Netanyahu? And is it the annexation of the occupied West Bank? There is an element to all of this of robbing Peter to pay Paul. You've got a ceasefire deal in Gaza. It's going to be implemented, at least phase one seems like it's going to happen. But the occupied West Bank, there's still a war going on there. The fear is that the Israelis will shift their focus even more to the occupied West Bank. What will that mean, generally speaking, for any ceasefire deal going forward and any other phases? Or do you think the two things are fairly separate?
Not at all separate. I mean, the Israelis have been so occupied with Hamas and Gaza, and they were trying to cognitively somewhat separate what happens in the West Bank, occupation in the West Bank, all this sort of coercion that happened in the West Bank over years and years and years, separating this from what happened in Gaza, which obviously you cannot do. And so eventually, and that's where I think long term, if you want peace in Gaza. And if you want to go to phase three, which is about reconstruction, which is about setting up a political, socio-political sort of socio-political element of governance in Gaza. If you want to get to this point, you need to create essentially a situation which leads at least, or has a pathway towards Palestinian self-determination. And Palestinian self-determination in this context also means that the situation in the West Bank can't be made worse, but that they actively have to work towards some sort of political solution there as well. Because phase three is really premised on this to happen. And that's why I'm so pessimistic about this deal ever being implemented, bringing this to an end, bringing this war to an end, because it will eventually mean you have to get peace in the West Bank.
The Jerusalem Post sharing this. IDF launches Operation Iron Wall against Palestinian terror in Jenin as PA exits. So this gets to what I've been talking about, what I was talking about leading up to the election. But essentially, this temporary ceasefire, as is understood by Netanyahu, and as Trump confirmed yesterday, this is a temporary ceasefire. It's not a full-on ceasefire. Heidi Matthews sharing here, Israel has launched Operation Iron Wall in the West Bank's Jenin on day two of Trump's presidency. It is named for a 1923 essay, The Iron Wall. Here's an extract. Zionist colonization can proceed and develop only behind an iron wall. So there's clearly an intention here to take over the West Bank. UN Human Rights account here writing, they are alarmed by a wave of renewed violence perpetrated by settlers and Israeli security forces in the occupied West Bank, coinciding with the implementation of the Gaza ceasefire agreement and the release of hostages and detainees. This has been accompanied by increased restrictions on Palestinians' freedom of movement across the West Bank, including complete closure of some checkpoints and installation of new gates, effectively confining entire communities. This report from back in June is one that I had consistently highlighted leading up to the election. Pro-Israel billionaire Miriam Adelson backs Trump campaign, pushes for West Bank annexation. Trump is simply a vessel for the interests of billionaires, be it tech bros, be it people like Miriam Adelson, where their issue is Israel dominating Palestinians. So this news that this is now happening is not surprising if you've been following Trump and what he actually cares about, which is nothing but money and serving those that give him money.
Diana Bhutu, as all of this was going on in Gaza, it was getting worse in the occupied West Bank. There was a war that was often unseen, unheard of by the international community going on. Israel was arresting by the thousands people, raiding refugee camps. It was killing people on an almost industrial scale when it came to the occupied West Bank. Where is the Palestinian Authority in all of this? They've come under a tremendous amount of criticism when it comes to Jenin refugee camp, for example, and facilitating Israeli raids there. Where's the occupied West Bank and the PA in all of this now?
I think it's important to keep in mind what Israel's done over this period, which is not just the raids, but also killing and also the taking over of Palestinian land. They've expropriated more land in the course of the past 15 months than they have in 20 years. And when it comes to the Palestinian Authority and where they are, the Palestinian Authority, we should really simply understand it as being no greater in power than a local mayor. And rather than them standing up and pushing and demanding an end to this genocide and trying to support Palestinians, we've seen that the Palestinian Authority has sat back and done nothing on the best case scenario. And in a worst case scenario, has actually gone after people in Jenin as well. It just shows just how the two are connected, how Israel is so connected to the Palestinian Authority. And as I and others have said in the past, the Palestinian Authority is no better than Israel's security subcontractor, which means that it's carrying out the work that Israel demands that it carry out. And this is because it's also at the request of the international community. We must break this mindset that somehow Palestinians are a security problem or a security threat, and instead be addressing the fundamental issue, which is the lack of Palestinian freedom. And once we put into place measures to make sure that Palestinians are free, then we won't be having this conversation about a Palestinian authority that is doing nothing to support its people.
A very quick follow-up, Diana, because you've made a very interesting point there. Is it then time for the Palestinian Authority to disband and we go back to the Palestine Liberation Organization, a resistance movement? Is that what you're saying?
You know, for a long time, I and others have been talking about dismantling the Palestinian Authority because it's overstayed its welcome. It was really only designed to be in place for a short period of time, for 5 years, and then to be replaced by a permanent Palestinian government that's elected. At the end of this month, Mahmoud Abbas will have been in power for 20 years. He was elected for four. And that's it. And unless we go down the path of not looking at just the Palestinian Authority as limited in jurisdiction, limited in the places in which it can operate, but instead transform it into a government that's representative of all Palestinians and that is pushing for liberation, for independence of all Palestinians and their land, then I'm afraid that we're going to be stuck in the same circle over and over again.
Mayrav, it's an opinion that I've heard over and over when I've been in Israel, when I've been in Palestine, where people say the Israelis just want us Palestinians to be happily occupied. They don't want us to kick up a fuss or do anything or do anything that will rock that particular boat. And Israel's been very, very successful at occupying the Palestinians. There's no impetus for Israel to change in any way its strategy of simply subjugating the Palestinians. There's no pressure at all, right?
No, there's no pressure, but I do think that the October 7th attacks are a good illustration of why it's not actually tenable. It might have been sustainable, but ultimately there is a price to pay for continuing to be an occupying power. And now after 15 months, Israel is wanted for war crimes. Israeli soldiers are trying to be tried or arrested abroad. Unfortunately, Netanyahu himself has not yet had to pay a price politically or internationally, but it is individual Israelis are and will start to pay that price. Israelis think about where they travel. Soldiers are going to have to think twice about what they're posting online. There's going to be changes in how Israelis understand the way they interact with the world. Ideally, the people in charge would be held to account first. But the way this process is starting, it's starting from the individual Israeli. I'm hoping that the trauma of October 7th, the lack of faith in this government, the fact that there is a real tension between the military, which, as you alluded to, wants to have a kind of enlightened and happy occupation, and a political echelon that wants full-on annexation, that out of that, Israelis who have been displaced from the north of Israel, from the south of Israel, who want this hostage deal and see that this government is working to undermine it, that they will start to change their political behavior and their voting patterns. It might take a long time, but at some point, and I think everybody sees that Israel's objective in Gaza, with all of the military that it's pushed and the destruction that it's caused, has not brought Israel any closer to removing Hamas from power or providing real security. So hopefully Israelis will start to realize that.
We see the heartbreaking interviews with Israeli hostage families who's demanding that Netanyahu sign the deal. We don't see that same intimate interviews with people on the streets in Gaza talking about what they've lost because the Israeli government bans all international journalists from being on the ground in Gaza. We're joined by Tala Nasser. She is a lawyer with the Palestinian prisoner and human rights organization Admir. If you can talk about the 90 Palestinians and who they are, as you are a lawyer with the prisoners organization.
Yes. So yesterday, Palestinian prisoners were supposed to be released after 3 p.m., but unfortunately, the Israeli authorities delayed the release until 3 a.m. Today. 92 Palestinian prisoners were released, including 69 female prisoners. Two of them are child prisoners. 20 of them are administrative detainees. Five of them were sentenced prisoners, and 44 were under trial. While they also released 23 child prisoners. Most of them were under administrative detention, and some of them were under trial. And also, six of the released prisoners yesterday were actually previously released in the November 23 exchange deal, and then they were re-arrested again. So these are the Palestinians who were released yesterday. And of course, we're waiting for the other phases or the other batches of the prisoners to be released.
And just for people to understand globally who don't know the Israeli system, when you say they were held administratively, you were saying they were held without charge or trial.
Yes, they were actually held without any charges, without any trial. It's based on a secret file that neither the detainee nor their lawyers know anything about the charges or the accusations and why they are arrested.
And overall, your feeling about the ceasefire, at least for these next 42 days?
We're actually concerned of what will actually going to happen in the next few weeks, because yesterday it was horrible. Families were actually waiting for long hours in front of Ofer prison. They were assaulted. The Israeli occupation forces started bombing the families, started using sound bombs, gas, rubber bullets, and live ammunition. There were lots of injuries in front of Ofer prison. So also families were also assaulted in the occupied Jerusalem. They were summoned to Al-Maskoubiyeh interrogation center. They were subjected to arbitrary conditions that prohibited gatherings and banned marches and fireworks and prevented them from chanting slogans. So the situation is still, we're still concerned of the situation. We're hoping that it will continue, the Israelis will continue to release prisoners of course, we have no guarantees they will not be rearrested again, but we are hopeful that many other prisoners will be released, especially the ones who are serving life sentences.
Tala, if you can talk about the release of Akhlida Jarar, a Palestinian parliamentarian, a member of the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Yeah, so Khalida was released also yesterday. She was completely isolated from the outside world for 5 months now. She was released with a horrible condition, actually, because of the isolation, because of the starvation imposed against her and other women prisoners, because of the lack of personal hygiene tools, the confiscation of clothes and electrical appliances, the denial of medical care. So she was released in a very horrible situation, and people around the world saw the pictures of how she was released. And it's not only about Khalid Jarrar, but it's also other women prisoners who were also released in a very bad situation, and they were subjected to different torture and ill-treatment methods, which led to their to them lose so much of their weight. They were starving inside the prisons, and that's why we saw them in this horrible situation.
Let's start with Khalida Jarrar there. Many people were shocked by her appearance compared to what she looked like when she went into detention. What did you think?
Yes, it wasn't shocking for us to see her looking like that, because we've been hearing from her lawyers about difficult stories about her situation inside Israeli jails, as she was put, as you say, there in solitary confinement. She could not reach out to the outer world. And this is part and parcel of what many, if not the vast majority, of Palestinian prisoners were going through after the war. All of these
extra measures that were taken by the Israeli forces against Palestinian prisoners were compared to collective punishment by Palestinians. We've seen the Israeli forces rounding up every day during Israeli raids to the occupied West Bank, dozens if not hundreds of Palestinians every day, sometimes releasing them after and sometimes keeping them under what's known administrative detention. And these detentions are arrest without charges, so without a trial, which means that these people can be there indefinitely. And with this situation that is inside jail, we've seen so many horrific before and after pictures of these Palestinian prisoners looking like they lost so much weight, they got sick. And one in particular, I remember, Muazzez Abayat, he was released out of jail and he could not recognize his own family. Mm. They were, running some tests, but they said that they feel that he had suffered so much mental pressure while he was in jail.
Why are these people being arrested? Why, for example, is Khalida Jarrah being arrested? You say there's no charge and they're held in administrative detention, which is indefinitely. What are they gaining from this?
Yeah, and it's not her first arrest even, and she had lost her daughter while she was in jail. She died and she could not attend her funeral. But as far as Israel is concerned, when it comes to Khalida, they see her as someone who's prominent, who could move the street in a certain way. They want to show that anyone and everyone could be arrested by the Israeli forces. So it's another measure by the Israeli forces to exercise power and control on Palestinians' lives, remind them who has the control. And so if they think of doing something to resist Israel's occupation, the price that they pay is going to be really, really high. So this is part of how occupation operates. But we've seen many Palestinians being arrested as young as 13, 14, and their charges could be, throwing rocks at the Israeli forces that are raiding Palestinian cities. And for many Palestinians, it's seen as a way that Israel wants to remind all generations that if they think to resist its occupation, the price is going to be very, very high.
Indeed it is. Nida Ibrahim, many thanks indeed for coming in.
What concerns you most about the future of the Palestinian people?
Basically, what concerns me the most is that as soon as this war is going to end, Israel will impose a permanent state of non-life on Gaza, leave every Gazan with the destruction that it created for the next decades, while at the same time, Gaza and Palestine will be pushed into complete irrelevancy. Everybody's going to pretend like it doesn't exist anymore and try to force us to look the other way. So that's going to be even more painful than the war. People just suffering every day, nonstop, indefinitely, without any option or horizon.
Let me come to Tamer in Doha. Tamer, you wrote a book about delivering aid into Gaza, the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip. That's part of the deal. But there is no way that anybody could have foreseen the sheer amount of damage that Israel has wrought on the Gaza Strip. This is going to be a decades-long process and it might well be able to begin in the phase deal, but it won't be completed.
Imran, true. I mean, the reality in Gaza is very grim. I mean, we're talking about estimates of between $50 billion to $80 billion. We're talking about decades to come for Gaza to recover, not in terms of infrastructure or environment itself. I mean, Gaza environmental ecosystem has been depleted, and it requires decades to recover. It's a very grim reality. There are many questions also. Who's going to pay this bill? I mean, the donors community, globally donors are facing what we call donors fatigue, with all these conflicts going around in Ukraine, then now the Middle East. And most importantly, even if there is a will to finance the reconstruction of Gaza, the international community requires guarantees now and assurances that these funds that will go to reconstruction will not be wasted again in a continuous circle of war. So what I'm trying to say is stability is a must this time. And for me, it's not clear yet. I mean, how is this reconstruction process going to kick off? Because again, politically, we live in a mess. I mean, the entire situation is still very messy. we see the Americans and Israelis saying there will be no reconstruction as long as Hamas is in power or in control of Gaza. But at the same time, they are negotiating with Hamas because Hamas did not go away.
For us, as we are displaced here, like over 1 million people are displaced in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. And even those who are living in the north, for example, they are already displaced in other parts because of that, you know, the lots of the evacuation orders that the army issued several times, and they are still issuing this. And they already issued the an evacuation order in the, before the announcement in 2 hours. So it is a moment of the of realization for all of us. Like we, eventually we are getting more close to that moment to be firstly accepting the reality of that, that there is another war that is just waiting for us after this war, because of the, there is a war of uncertainty, there is a war of rebuilding, the war of the people who already left us and the memories that we left as well. So, and you know, like the majority of the people in Gaza are struggling with grief, trauma, and other, you know, other psychological aspects. And I can say that having this step, it will be a real action for us, like to do something. It's been like almost 15 months of being on hold, all everything, like our feelings, our days. Like I can tell, like today, I'm feeling that I'm getting back to the 8th of October. So I, yeah, the genocide started on the 7th of October. We have never seen the 8th of October till the moment of the announcement of this ceasefire. So I can tell that now we are still stick back with 2023, the 7th of October, and we're living now the 8th of the 7th of the October. That means that how time is stopped with those people here because of agony. They are singing in agony and grief over everything, literally everything. What I mean, nobody here has lost nothing. Like if your home is still standing, your beloved ones, friends, whatever, they are still with you. You are not losing your source of income, but yet you lost your hope in humanity. You lost your insecurity as well. You lost that sense of insecurity, and the let me say that the education in terms of the kids who already lost 2 academic years in a row because of the ongoing genocide. So everyone lost something here, and nobody we are celebrating, but it doesn't mean we are celebrating out of joy. We are celebrating out of grief, because eventually we will have that moment to break down, to get that chance to deal with our hardships and our problems that occurred during this genocide.
Shruk Ela, independent journalist in Gaza. I want to turn to what happened at the State Department yesterday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, with his farewell news conference, had 2 journalists forcibly removed from his final press briefing after they questioned him on the Biden administration's policies in Gaza. This is the exchange between Blinken and Max Blumenthal, editor of The Gray Zone.
300 reporters in Gaza were on the receiving end of your bombs. Why did you keep the bombs flowing when we had a deal in May? We all knew we had a deal. Everyone in this room knows we had a deal, Tony, and you kept the bombs flowing. Why did you sacrifice the rules-based order on the mantle of your commitment to Zionism? Why did you allow my friends to be massacred? Why did you allow my friends' homes in Gaza to be destroyed when we had a deal in May? You helped destroy our religion, Judaism, by associating it with fascism. You waved the white flag before
Netanyahu. We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
You waved the white flag before Israeli fascism.
We'll have the time to take questions at the end.
Your father-in-law was an Israel lobbyist. Your grandfather was an Israel lobbyist. Are you compromised by Israel? Why did you allow the Holocaust of our time to happen? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? How does it feel to have your legacy be genocide? You too, Matt. You smirk through the whole thing every day.
A few minutes later, the independent journalist Sam Husseini was also dragged out of the room as he shouted out,
"Finally, I just wanted to share this morning.
Get your hands off me. Get your hands off me. Get your hands off me.
Answer a damn question.
I look forward to answering questions in 2 minutes.
You know about Israel's nuclear weapons, everybody from the ICJ. I was sitting here quietly, and now I'm being manhandled by two or three people. You pontificate about a free press. Sir, you pontificate about a free press. You are hurting me. I am asking questions after being told by Matt Miller that he will not answer my questions until I'm asking
questions. Please, sir, respect the process. We'll have an opportunity to take questions in 2 minutes.
Wasn't the point of the May 31st statement to block the ICJ orders? You blocked the ICJ orders?
Please, sir, respect the process. Thank you.
Oh, respect the process. Respect the process. While everybody from Amnesty International, to the ICJ is saying that Israel's doing genocide and extermination, and you're telling me to respect the process. Criminal! Why aren't you in the Hague?
Journalist Sam Husseini was being taken out even before he asked a question. They had gathered around him as Max Blumenthal was taken out. Gideon Levy, if you can respond to journalists breaking the kind of consensus at the State Department and challenging Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State.
I wish there would have been more. I wish there would have been journalists like this in Israel, which you hardly see. Blinken is a typical American liberal, like the Yair Lapids and the Benny Gantz and the Israeli Zionist leftists or the Israeli liberals. They have very clear borders to what should be said and what shouldn't be said. They always say the right things and do exactly the opposite. Blinken cannot break away from his accountability to what is happening in Gaza. Blinken and Biden, they say the most noble things about humanitarian aid, about the right of the Palestinians to live in peace and to have their own rights, beautiful things. In the same time, they finance, they armed this horrible weapon, this horrible war, without putting any conditions to Israel. And they will be judged not according their nice talkings, but according to their policy and their actions. And their actions lead only to one conclusion. What happened in Gaza, which is quite clear already that it is totally criminal, has two main responsible factors. One is obviously the Israeli leadership, and the second one is the American administration. And no beautiful talkings will release Blinken and Biden from their responsibility to 20, 30,000 killed children and babies and women, 50, 60, maybe 70,000 people killed in Gaza, total destruction by American weapons which were delivered to Israel without putting any condition to Israel. That's the reality. And Max Blumenthal and others try to call the bluff and try to say the truth. And I'm very sorry that their voice is not legitimate.
This is a very limited agreement to deal with a very specific issue, namely a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and an Israeli-Palestinian exchange of captives and hostages. And it's a very fragile one. I believe Netanyahu will do everything possible with collusion of certain Trump officials to try to scuttle it after the first phase. At the same time, I think the most that can be hoped for at this stage is a return to the U.S. policy of strategic neglect of the question of Palestine. But let's recall that's what got us into this mess in the first place.
That's it for this hour. On today's show, we looked into the latest ceasefire reached in Gaza. What are the political environment in the U.S. and Israel that surrounds that deal? And can it be trusted to last? How can Palestinians rebuild Gaza after the massive destruction and trauma Israel caused? And what is Israel doing in occupied West Bank right now while the world is busy with Gaza? Is the Palestinian Authority helping the Israeli occupation attack Palestinians in West Bank? If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to their archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.